Remembering Dr. Oliver Smithies, who died earlier this week, WCHL is rebroadcasting his Who's Talking interview with D.G. Martin, recorded in February of 2011. Here's D.G. with Nobel Prize winner Dr. Oliver Smithies.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I bet you've heard about the award-winning film The King's Speech. Maybe even many people in Chapel Hill have seen it. But in any event, you've heard about how King George VI overcame his stuttering problem to give what was a very important speech at the very beginning of World War II, in which he had to attempt to rally the British people together as the war began. And so we've seen, many of us have seen that in the movie. My guest, our Chapel Hill neighbor and the Nobel laureate and professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Dr. Oliver Smithies, has some memory of those days. And Dr. Smithies, welcome.
No, thank you. I'm very glad to see you again.
Well, it's wonderful to see you again as well. And we're not talking about genetic research today. We're talking about memories. And I wonder if we can just kind of listen to a little bit of this speech that's the subject of the King's Speech and see if it brings back memories.
I would love to hear
and
it
then
again.
Afterwards, we'll talk some more.
In this grave hour, perhaps the most fateful in our history, I send to every household of my people, both at home and overseas, this message, spoken with the same depth of feeling for each one of
you. Dr. Smithies, that's not exactly what we saw in the movie, but it's pretty close, isn't
it? Yes, it's remarkably close. The movie is remarkably close, we should say.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, of course.
Remarkably so.
Well, it had been many years since you'd heard that speech, but I wonder if listening to it again, or seeing the movie and then listening to it again, or a piece of it again right now, brings back what memories does it bring back?
Oh, it brings back many memories. I was 14 at the time, and of course we'd had all of the problems with the... Now, I get my facts wrong in this
sense. No, nobody...
The problems with the Chamberlain and the concessions that were made and the feeling that really wasn't the way to go. And so all of us were very concerned about what would happen on that day, because on the September 3rd, there was an
I should have set it up. This was September. The speech was given on September 3rd,
yes,
1939.
That's correct.
You correct me, but the Nazis had invaded Poland, I guess, and
the earlier problem had been Czechoslovakia,
yes,
hadn't it? Yeah, and then they'd invaded Poland.
And you said either stop or we'll have to go to war.
That's right.
And so they didn't stop.
The deadline or the ultimatum was for 11 o'clock that day, and it was a Sunday. And I'd been to church with my family. I have a twin brother, and I had a twin brother. He's no longer with us, but I had a twin brother and a sister. And
so your church, going to church as a family group?
Yes, we were members of the choir. The boys were members
of
the choir.
What city? What town?
It was actually not in a town. It was in a village. The village was a Copley village, I visited there this last summer. I'll tell you about that later. Anyway, we were coming back from
And are you walking, or are you in the...
Walking, yes, we were walking. We could walk from there to where we lived. And I remember walking there, and this feeling of 11 o'clock was such a critical time. I don't know exactly when it was we knew that the Germans had not withdrawn, but it must have been within minutes of that, because somebody must have had a radio or thereabouts. So radios weren't that common. And then I remember later hearing the King give that speech.
But so you knew from the 11 o'clock deadline that you were going to have to be at war.
Yes, that's
correct. But you then were told that the King would speak. Or
that I can't remember well enough, D.G. I can remember hearing someone, and this was not the king, saying that the 11 o'clock time had passed and therefore we were at war. But the king then assumed that people knew that by the time he was talking. Mm-hmm. So he was giving his speech later in the day. And I don't know what time of the day it was, but I'm sure I heard it. At least if I didn't, I think
you
I
can, you remember it now,
because I remember all the feelings. And when I saw the movie, it just was very, it was very moving, really, because it brought back all those memories of the trouble that was to come.
One of my great memories was I was so touched after the. Having watched the movie.
Yes.
And then watching you watch the movie.
Yes.
And then when the movie was over,
yeah,
you stayed in your seat and watched the credits.
I always enjoy looking at the credits and of good movies.
Of good movies.
I mean, you don't bother if it's not a good movie. But if it's a good movie, then the credits are important, because you like to know, often you like to know exactly where was it filmed, for example, and who was this and who was that. And unfortunately, they zip through those things so quickly nowadays that you really can't see the names of the actors along the character.
Well, you had to deal with me interrupting you to say, would you come talk to me about this?
Yes. I was very glad to see you there and remember our time together before.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to also ask, one of the things that we learned in the film,
mm-hmm.
or at least that I learned as a result of the discussions, was that George VI was had a problem with his speech, that he stuttered or stammered.
Yes.
And although I'd grown up while he was king and had a great positive opinion of him, I didn't know about this. And I wondered whether or not this was widely known by people in England.
Yes, I think it was known. That's a little vague, because in my mind, because it was his way of speaking, as in the speech, was so characteristic of the way he talked whenever he did talk, that it didn't seem particularly special. But I think all of us knew that he had some difficulty with speech. I don't remember it being talked about very, very much. It was just known.
We're visiting with Dr. Oliver Smithies, and we're talking about the King's speech and his recollections of the speech and the times. And we'll continue that conversation after the short break.
The threat of force against the sovereignty and independence of other states. Such a principle, stripped of all disguise, is surely the mere primitive doctrine that might is right. And if this principle were established throughout the world, the freedom of our own country and of the whole the British Commonwealth of Nations would be in danger.
Remembering Dr. Oliver Smithies, who died earlier this week, WCHL is rebroadcasting his Who's Talking interview with D.G. Martin, recorded in February of 2011. Here's D.G. with Nobel Prize winner Dr. Oliver Smithies. Remembering Dr. Oliver Smithies, who died earlier this week, WCHL is rebroadcasting his Who's Talking interview with D.G. Martin, recorded in February of 2011. Here's D.G. with Nobel Prize winner Dr. Oliver Smithies.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Dr. Oliver Smithies and I are celebrating this great movie, The King's Speech, and Dr. Smithies, thanks for coming and sharing some of your memories of those times.
It's very much a pleasure to be here. And that movie is a really a marvelous movie in my mind. And I had the feeling I'd like to go and see it again. In fact, I sent a message to one of my great friends in who are now in visiting or have their second home in New Mexico. And I said, if you haven't seen this movie, let's go together.
Let's go together
and see it again. And I, because it captures very much the feeling of people at that time.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, you were a 14-year-old about this time, and I wonder whether you can remember how that day and the announcement of war and the coming of war What memories do you have about your life before and after and the changes that took place afterwards?
At the time, it didn't immediately change my life in any way because, of course, the beginning of a war before people are generally recruited is still a matter of the professional soldier, you might say. But then later on, people volunteered to serve or were called up as there was a draft. My father was over the age of to be affected by the draft, but he had the feeling, I don't know, a sort of mystical feeling, I think you can say it was more than anything else. He had the idea that if he served, his boys wouldn't have to serve. Mm. You see, we were 14 and it was obviously we wouldn't be drafted for some time, but he had the feeling anyway later on in the war that if he served, it would prevent his boys from having to serve.
Well, and so what was his service?
And he served in the... he wasn't, I've forgotten what it's called, the Ordnance Corps, I think it was called, the Supply Corps. He served in India and I think in Burma as well. No, India for sure. And he really had a pretty tough time.
So then he was gone for a long time.
Oh, he was gone a long time, yes. He got malaria and he got diphtheria.
What did your what was your father's occupation?
He was an insurance salesman.
Really?
At that
time. In a small village in... In
the north of England, in Yorkshire. As a matter of fact, I visited there this last summer to the elementary, the primary school, Copley. The school was still there.
The same school?
Oh, yeah. And I didn't recognize it. I thought it was a new building because here was this beautiful-looking sandstone building. And I remember the school I went to had black walls. But you see, that's what happened with getting rid of pollution. The walls, then the stone weathered back to its natural.
Was Copley? Was this an industrial town? Or?
It was part of the industrial West Riding of Yorkshire, and Halifax, which was the nearby town, the bigger town, was very much
had lots of smokestacks.
But it wasn't oddly enough, it wasn't the smokestacks which caused the pollution. It was the
coal
fires. People heated their houses with poor coal, and it was dirty and polluting, and nothing grew downtown. No, and you could go on the local, we called it Beacon Hill. It was a beacon for the Armada, I think. but anyway, it was a nearby hill, and you could go up there, and you usually wouldn't be able to see the town because it would be in fog or smog.
With black smoke.
And now you can go there, and it's beautiful. But anyway, going back to the Copley story, because it's an enjoyable one for me, is they asked me to... If I would come and they would unveil a plaque
in the school.
To say that Oliver Smithies had been at this school.
First learned his science in this school.
From age 5 until 11. I was at that school from 5 until 11. And so when I went into the school, I was amazed because the rooms were small, but very practical. Now maybe 16 students in a room, and there would be only 30 students in a year, you might say. That would be the total entry. And so it was a small school, but it was very effective. And now the kids, even six-year-olds, here they are with 12 computers. Quite different. But the headmistress was the principal of the school. She was very, I was very impressed.
Well, I always wonder, as I get older, going back to my old neighborhoods when I was a child, you kind of want to see the people who were there when you left.
Yes.
And they've been gone for years.
There were a couple of people
who was still there?
I don't actually remember all of the people who... there were a couple of people. I knew, of course, my cousin, who was about 5 years younger than me, who is about 5 years younger than
and
me.
And he's still there.
And he arranged this thing. He'd been a headmaster and a magistrate and things of that sort, and he thought this might be a good idea. And it turned out to be very enjoyable with the little children, and they one stage they said, who would like to have a photograph taken with Dr. Smith? as they called me. And all these kids rushed up and put their arms around
me.
Well. I felt real special. But anyway, we were talking about how the war affected me. And later on, when my, as I mentioned, my father then went to serve. And by the time I was 18, then we're now 1943.
So where are you? Are you still in school in Kapla, or have you gone to university?
No, by then, when I was 14, so we'd already moved to another house, which was in the nearby town, or city, we would call it, I suppose, 100,000 people.
Which is the name?
It was Halifax.
Halifax.
Halifax
mm-hmm.
was the name of the town. And there I went to a high school. It was a very old grammar school. Had been founded, believe it or not, in 1597.
Oh, no.
Wow. An Elizabethan
and
grammar
this
school.
A, this
and
is
still a
you,
school.
We have a hard time understanding the terminology for British schools, but this was what we would call
a high school.
A high school, and it was... one that's opened every. It's not a. You have to pay tuition. This is
no. In fact, it was on a road that was called a free school lane because it had been free always.
Well,
and it wasn't a very big grammar school. In fact, it remarkably small when you think about a town of 100,000. How many? How big a high school would be in this country? And at that time, this high school had an entry of only 60 students. Per year, so they and the 5 years, so we can do the multiplication.
Well, by this time, with
300
your,
students.
With your move, the war is coming into
it's
really making a difference in your father and your friend's fathers are going away. Some are getting word that they have been killed and.
And then
things look bleak.
So my mother, of course, had to look after the family, and she was a teacher of English language at the local technical college. In fact, she had been a teacher there when my father was a pupil.
Oh, wow! Well,
so it was one of
another
these
story.
Oh, yeah, another story. but anyway. Then at 18, I was about the time, well, probably 17, I had the time to take various exams to go to college. And I was fortunate to get a scholarship at one of the colleges of Oxford University.
And so that's when you left to go to
and
Oxford.
And so I went there, and I started off as a medical student. But didn't continue as a medical student. I later became decided to do research in chemistry. But I've never quite understood how I didn't get drafted. But they had some sort of a committee that met, which I never appeared at. I had nothing to do with this. And they would determine whether you went into the army or whether you served your completed your education. And I was drafted, as it were, in a sense, to complete my education, and I never served in the armed forces.
So but they must have identified you as a bright student.
It had some different. There were differences because my brother, twin brother, not identical, but twin brother, he also was directed to finish his college work as an engineering student, but he had to serve in the army afterwards. I never understood why there was any difference and how this came about.
Well, that's probably something we'll never understand.
No.
Well, both in your high school experience in Halifax and then also at Oxford, we read about the bombings and the German blitz, particularly as far as London is concerned, but were the other British villages and towns subject to air attack?
Well, in for example, when I went to the let me think of the date. When I went to Oxford, we all served in I was in the what would be equivalent to the ROTC, we had what was called fire watching duty, and we had that when I was a high school student. You would stay in the school overnight, and if there was anything dropped on the roofs, for example, an incendiary bomb or something of that sort. Incendiaries were rather commonly used, in fact, more than high explosives in some situations, and then one was taught what to do. But in fact, I never had any.
Didn't have to do that.
Happen. The nearest I came to being involved in it was by the time what we call the doodlebug came along. That was a V-1. That was
the missile, not the
supersonic, space age one, but it was a rather crude jet-propelled bomb, if you like. It would go on for a length of time, then the engine would shut off and it would dive into the ground. And it had a characteristic noise which you could recognize, like
you could hear it coming.
Yes, and if you heard it stop, you knew. And I remember in my hometown, in Halifax, that happening and hearing it and saying to my parents, "That's a noodle bomb. I think we'd better go to the shelter." And we had a shelter which we dug. You dug one in your garden and covered things over with it. And which we dug together, and then it landed on some field in the countryside. And I went up there looking for it, and I remember finding a piece of the shrapnel from it, and it had been near a Yorkshire farmhouse, and those are solid structures with stone shingles, not even slate. They were thick stone. It just blew the windows out. That's all it did. It didn't damage it, but that was the nearest I came to actually being involved. We did have. After Dunkirk, when the British army was forced to withdraw.
This was after the Germans swept through France
blocked
the British and remaining French troops.
Yeah, they came through Belgium and
and they were just sort of surrounded.
Exactly. And we had, at that time, we weren't one of the few local houses that had a telephone because my father's business required a telephone. So the army came and used our house as a center, and some of the soldiers who came back from Dunkirk were there on our in our garden.
We're visiting with
rather vaguely, but I remember
with Dr. Oliver Smithies in the context of the recent award-winning movie The King's Speech. We're reminiscing about his growing up time in England at the same time. He and I'll be right back, but before we leave you, we'll play and listen to just another very short segment of King George VI's speech at the opening of World War II. Dr. Smithies and I'll be right back.
As if I were able to cross your threshold and speak to you myself. For the second time in the lives of most of us, we are at war. Over and over again, we have tried to find a peaceful way out of the differences between ourselves and those who are now our enemies. But it has been in vain. We have been forced into a conflict, for we are called with.
Remembering Dr. Oliver Smithies, who died earlier this week, WCHL is rebroadcasting his Who's Talking interview with D.G. Martin, recorded in February of 2011. Here's D.G. with Nobel Prize winner Dr. Oliver Smithies. Remembering Dr. Oliver Smithies, who died earlier this week, WCHL is rebroadcasting his Who's Talking interview with D.G. Martin, recorded in February of 2011. Here's D.G. with Nobel Prize winner Dr. Oliver Smithies.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Oliver Smithies, our Chapel Hill neighbor, professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, distinguished researcher and Nobel laureate. We're not talking about any of that, but we're talking about the King's Speech, the movie, and Dr. Smithies' memories about those times, and we've gone all wonderful. Wonderful memories. One of the things, Dr. Smithies, in the movie that I think is something Americans are intrigued with because they're not as familiar with it,
yes.
And that is the distinction in classes and among British people, as it was up until and maybe a little bit after this time. If it were royalty or a duke or somebody, you treated them differently. Or
yes.
They treated you differently.
Of course, I never had the opportunity to meet a duke. So,
is that right? Never,
king.
Never met a duke or king?
No,
well, you met the king of...
You
met the Scandinavian king, didn't you?
Yes. He was very, very much very easy to talk to. He was quite not a bit of a standoffish at all.
Well, you remember in the movie when Mr. Logue wanted to call the king, or at the beginning, he said, "I'll call you Bertie."
Yeah.
Oh no, you'll call me Your Highness. and I guess that there were different customs. And
yes.
Do you have memories of those, or was it so? Ordinary people
that was all so distant. It really didn't have much bearing on my life anyway. That sort of distinction. But I must say, since we were talking about the movie, really, I did enjoy the fact that Lionel, who's the speech therapist, said to the king, "This is my territory, and we have my rules here."
Even though you're the king.
Even though you're
the
king.
That would be sort of hard to put over even today.
Yes, that's right. But anyway, there was definitely a distinction made. And I felt rather fortunate to come from the north of England, from Yorkshire, because it was always said in Yorkshire, Jack's as good as his boss.
Oh.
Jack is as good as his boss.
So this is a working, this is industrial working.
Yes.
And
there weren't any of those distinctions in my hometown at all. I remember nothing of that sort at all. When I went to Oxford, I was fortunate to go to a very, I would say it was
the
best college. You know,
which was what?
But I think academically it would be generally agreed.
Now, which was the college?
Balliol College.
Oh,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
But I think it would generally be acknowledged as it is, in fact, the best academic
uh-huh.
college. But it had no marked class distinctions that I ever met.
So if you in your college.
Yes, that's right.
Even if you were the son of a duke or a prince,
yes.
You were treated as much as you could.
I think there was a bit of an aristocracy in the college, but the aristocracy was more academic. That's
yes.
to say, if you
like
were,
here,
if,
as
if,
here.
If,
yeah.
if you were a good
like
scholar, you were treated with more respect, as it were, than if you were a poor scholar.
Well, it's interesting. You would be interested in this, that Erica Eisdorfer wrote a wonderful book about England in the 19th century, I guess, and class distinctions, and I pressed her to say why she got interested in this class thing. She said, "I work in the most class in an arena in which there is so much class and rank and honor, and we have to learn to deal with it because with professors, staff, all different kinds of grades of staff at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, so maybe." Class distinctions in academic institutions.
Yeah, but there was still various distinctions. I think the North of England accent was made as a sort of measure of class distinction. And I remember applying for the thespians, the Oxford Dramatic Group, and I'd actually done quite well parts in my hometown, and I never even was considered, and I'm fairly sure that had in relation to how I talk, but I remember also one time talking to somebody about pronunciation, and because he made fun of me.
So you had an accent that was not right for the upper class
yes,
academic
absolutely.
Stage.
And I went across the field to go to the boat race. I went across the field, you see, not the field, the field where you could hear both sounds, the I and the E. And I was going to go to the boat race where you could hear both, still those two
sounds.
I can't sounds.
Tell the differences in your...
Boat race and boat race, now you can hear the A.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now field and field, you can hear the E in the second one, but not in... you can hear the IE in the second
and
one,
those,
but not in the
your difference of pronunciation sets you apart, at least for
yes,
drama.
And I said, I'm not going to change. And I decided, am I going to take an, am I going to have an Oxford accent? Why do I want an Oxford accent? I've got my own. I'm happy with it.
So you have some sympathy with those of us who are Southerners, and when we go away, people try to break us of the way we talk, and we hold on.
You shouldn't hold. Although I did have an interesting incident in that case, my own talking about Southern accent, because my hobby is flying, and I went to Harnett County Airport, County Airport at Irwin, here in North Carolina, and I met this man whose name was Cecil. And now Cecil, for me, was a bit strange because I had a friend in Oxford, and he was called Cecil.
Cecil, of course.
Not Cecil, but so Cecil, and he had a very heavy Southern accent. I could hardly tell what he said, but we were friends. And then I, for various reasons, didn't go back to that airport for a long time. I went there with my wife about a couple of years ago now, and I asked, is Cecil still around? And they said, oh, yes, he's here. He's, in fact, there he is over there in the plaid shirt. Oh, I said, I'll go and talk to him, and went over to him, and, you know, he'd lost his accent.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he didn't have an accent anymore.
And did he explain it to you, or you just...
No, but you haven't taken the right thought, because the reason was...
Oh, because...
The Southern accent was no longer a heavy accent to me.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
No, I missed the whole point.
Your ear had... I knew you would miss it. but it's interesting, isn't it? Because I missed it, you see.
Your ear had become accustomed.
I didn't think... It took me a moment to realize.
Well, that's the... that'll be the mark, then, that... How do you know when you've become a Southerner? And that is when... Cecil speaks, he no longer has an accent.
Yes, that's right.
Well, of course, at Biltmore up in Asheville, the family that owns it are the Cecils, spelled the same way as Cecil, because they came at the... From England.
Yes, well, one of my great friends as a student was Rupert Cecil. He had some...
Connections
with a very aristocratic, but even not a bit of an aristocratic person in that sense. He was he'd served in World War II as in the Air Force, and in fact he was a wing commander and had more than 50 missions, I think, and survived. And I remember meeting him one time when I went back to England, and being rather obnoxious. That's to say, I was being rather obnoxious, because I was sort of bragging to him. I said, you know, I flew all three, at that time I had three airplanes. I said, I flew all three of my airplanes on the same day on my birthday. And he sort of nonchalantly said, oh yes, I remember one day when I flew a Tiger Moth, a Spitfire, and an Avro Lancaster all on the same day.
Well,
and that was the training aircraft, the best fighter that England produced, and the best bomber that England produced, all on the same day. It was a marvellous put-down, because he really didn't put me down. I just felt marvellous to be talking to somebody who had been like that. Because I was still at the university when the war was over.
Well, we're visiting with Dr. Oliver Smithies. We're talking about and around The King's Speech, the award-winning movie. Dr. Smithies and I'll be right back.
Remembering Dr. Oliver Smithies, who died earlier this week, WCHL is rebroadcasting his Who's Talking interview with D.G. Martin, recorded in February of 2011. Here's D.G. with Nobel Prize winner Dr. Oliver Smithies. Remembering Dr. Oliver Smithies, who died earlier this week, WCHL is rebroadcasting his Who's Talking interview with D.G. Martin, recorded in February of 2011. Here's D.G. with Nobel Prize winner Dr. Oliver Smithies.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Dr. Oliver Smithies. We're talking about his memories of England during the time of the King's Speech, the World War II, and afterwards. And a couple of real quick questions. First of all, Edward VIII, the king who married the American and gave up his crown, kind of romantic.
Yes.
My mother used to always tell me that King Edward VIII was very popular in England, and that he was sort of a man of the people, and that the people really loved him more than they liked the other royalty. Did you have any memory? Was she right about this?
No, oddly enough, I don't have as much memories of him as I have of King George. Somehow he was a person that you It's crazy that you should feel this way, but you're fond of...
You were fond of King George VI, but not...
Oh, yes. Well, I don't remember feeling that way at all.
No
about,
way.
About Edmund.
Just moving on, what about the two princesses, about Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret?
Oh, they were fun, really, because the Princess Elizabeth, and of course now Queen Elizabeth, her birthday is almost the same as mine.
So you celebrate the Queen's birthday and Dr. Oliver Smithy's birthday at the same time.
And I don't think of it that way, but they are fairly similar. We're within a few months of each other.
Amazing to me, she is this sort of figure that spans time.
Yes, I thought that movie that was made of her life was a remarkably good one,
Yeah,
too.
Very,
so.
Well, before we stop, also, we heard the King's speech, and at the moment that the World War II started, out with Chamberlain and the old guard, and in with Churchill. And what were your... we hear these contradictory... You're a great American hero. Oh. But we hear these contradictory things about him in terms of the way British people viewed him. What did you all think of Churchill?
Oh, of Churchill? No, I don't really think at the time there was anything contradictory about him at that time. He was a marvelous... he was a marvelous speaker, for one thing. Mm. And you could listen to him, and you could listen all day, as it were. But everybody would go and gather around whatever radio they had or way to listen and listen to his speeches, and they were inspiring. They really were inspiring speeches.
We hardly remember it any longer, but in those days the radio was still new.
Relatively new. I remember the days when still it was crystal radio. I mean, that's unbelievable.
So it was even more powerful. I don't want to say that WCHL isn't a powerful voice in Chapel Hill, but even more the radio brought people together.
Yes, it was. People can remember when TV was still exciting. There are enough people alive anyway who can remember when that was an exciting time, when TV first became available here in this country. Well, that was about the same time as far as radio was concerned, maybe a little past that time, but it was fairly... not everybody had a radio.
Yeah.
Well, because my mother, I remember, because during the Depression, she was short of... our family was short of money, as everybody was, and she tried to sell... She was supposed to sell her radio to...
Oh, to get... for to bread.
To get enough food for us. And... but she couldn't do it, and so when the person came to listen to it, she said, "Well, it has some awful noises it makes," and she said she talked it down enough that the person didn't buy it.
Well, we've been visiting with Dr. Oliver Smithies. We've been talking about the King's speech, the recent movie, and also Dr. Smithies' recollections about that time. And thank you for coming. I thought we saved just a little bit of time, and as we close, we'll just listen to just a moment or two of King George VI's speech.
I would love
to
hear that.
Thanks for coming, and I'm going to think of another excuse to get you back.
Oh, well, this is a marvelous speech to have brought us together.
Thank you. And thanks to all y'all for listening. Stay and listen just to a tad of King George VI's speech at the beginning of World War II. And this is Who's Talking. I'll be right back here soon.
And the peoples of the world would be kept in the bondage of fear, and all hopes of settled peace and of the security of justice and liberty among nations would be ended. This is the ultimate issue which confronts us for the sake of all that we ourselves hold dear, and of the world order and peace. It is unthinkable that we should refuse to meet the challenge. It is for this high purpose that I now call my people at home and my peoples across the seas, who will make our cause their own. I ask them to stand calm and firm and united in this time of trial. The task will be hard. There may be dark days ahead and war I can no longer be confined to the battlefield. But we can only do in the light as we see the light and reverently commit our cause to God. If one and all we keep resolutely faithful to it, ready for whatever service or sacrifice it may demand, and then with God's help, we shall prevail. May he bless and keep us all.